Folks, just a couple minutes early, which is, if you can get an early start, always a good thing to do. It is that time of year. It is a time of year that I refer to as the holidays, and occasionally some people get all triggered. It's a war on Christmas. I love Christmas. Look at me. I'm Santa Jack, right? When I say the holidays, I'm talking about the time that we're entering right now. So that's Thanksgiving, Christmas to New Year's, that whole time, that's when families get together, people travel, they have meals together, and of course, it all kicks off on a wonderful Thursday we call Thanksgiving, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. Going back 15 years, which seems crazy, I first did a show on getting ready for Thanksgiving and cooking and making it great with, at the time, our expert council member for cooking, and that was Chef Keith Snow. We never did another one. That was it. We never did another one. 15 years. It's like, hey, you know what? Things have changed. There's new technology, new ideas, new concepts, and we have a great new chef. And I want to say an upgrade in chefs with Chef Ken Daniels. So I reached out to Ken last week and said, bro, are you free next Wednesday? We could do a show on this. And that way people have like a whole weekend and then another half a week before they have to apply what we give them. Because some of the stuff like, take your turkey out of the freezer soon. Needs to happen like not the day before Thanksgiving, which I think is how we did the original version of the show. Maybe we did it that Tuesday, I guess, because Wednesday's usually the Thanksgiving special. So I'm going to have Ken on just a bit. We're going to be talking about a bunch of stuff. We are going to talk about everything from making a great turkey, some ways to keep your food warm, how to distract your guests and keep them what I call the hell out of my kitchen, because I don't have that big of a kitchen. I don't want people hanging out in the kitchen while I'm doing final prep. And we're going to talk about sides. We're going to talk about desserts. We're going to talk about beverages, desserts, all of it. We'll give you a bunch of great tips and some stuff you can use to make it all happen. Before we do that, I'm not really going to do sponsors today, but I do have an item of the day that I thought I would just give you right up front because it's a cooking item. You may or may not use for Thanksgiving, but you guys know I have been recommending cast iron skillets for a very long time. They're kind of my go-to. I actually like them in a lot of ways better for not all things, but many things than cast iron. They're lighter. They heat up quicker. They do an awesome sear. And I've always recommended Lodge. And the reason I've always recommended Lodge is they were the most affordable that was a really good quality product, but they weren't without flaws. There's a couple things I don't really care for with Lodge. One, they have that kind of pitted cast style finish, even on their carbon steel. And they kind of have a little high spot right in the center of the pan, which can be annoying if you're doing eggs or something and it wants to run off on you. I'd also say the sidewalls on them are a little bit low and maybe a little bit too shallow of angle. Well, about 6 months ago, someone from a company called Merton and Stork reached out to me. And then they went dark and they didn't answer me anymore. But I was like, I'm intrigued. So I picked up one of their pans. I've been using it now for quite a few months and it is freaking fantastic. It is a dead smooth milled surface, a little bit higher pitch and a little bit higher sides. And it does not have any kind of a, you know, high spot in the center. It's a perfectly flat level pan. This is like super chef level quality. And so what are you going to pay? What's the price differential? Because this is why I never recommended pans like this, because they're $200. This one's going to cost you a dollar or two more or less than a Lodge on any given day. So I have moved my recommendation. Like, I'm not going to get rid of my Lodge pans. I'm not telling you to either. But if you're going forward and you need a good carbon steel skillet, check these things out. Merton & Stork is German company, German engineering. Really beautiful job they did on these pans. And you might just have a use for some pans in the coming week. The other thing is a foodie is going to love this. So check out the review on that. And we'll go ahead now and bring Chef Ken on to the show. Chef Ken, welcome to the Survival Podcast, man.
Hello, everybody. How we doing?
I think we're doing good, man. Hey, I'm glad you took some time to be with us. I know you've been like busting your ass butchering deer and bison and ibex and whatever the hell else that hunters are bringing right now, because you're just that dude. You like, when you want to learn how to do something new, you just go start, you know, doing it for somebody. So I'm glad you had the time to be with us today, bro.
No problem. I've never been more exhausted learning a skill. And to hell with all my credentials. You know, I'm getting in there and scraping floors and really cut into some exotic. And then, like, bro, we're doing about 100 deer a day. And so I woke up last night, my wrist was, my hand was completely numb just because of all the work, but I've never been happier. Learning a new skill, a new trade, it's amazing. So and I'm going to be happy to be sharing that with all the TSP listeners. So.
I don't know if maybe while I'm talking, you can check your mic or something. I'm getting a little pop in there for some reason.
Oh
I'm
yeah,
not sure.
let me check it. Hold on a second.
Yeah.
I think that's better.
Okay, yeah.
It
All right,
might be
cool.
my damn dog. If it is, I'll put him in the room. So.
I don't think so. It's more like a pop, 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 pop
Oh,
when
interesting.
you're talking only.
Oh, interesting. Okay, cool. Well, if you hear it again, let
Yeah.
me know. We'll see if I can switch out the mic
I'm
or
hearing it
something.
now. I'm
Good
hearing it now. I
Lord.
don't know if you can switch mics or.
Yeah, can you put me on hold just one second? I'll
Yeah.
grab the other. Yep.
All right, so I'm gonna talk while he's doing that. This is the perils of live podcasting here with some sound in the background. Maybe I'll edit this out for the audio side only. But let me just tell you what I'm hoping that we can do for you guys today. I'm hoping we can make your Thanksgiving just go smoother, right? Like, just there's so many things that can make this complicated. One is you tell everybody to show up at, like, let's say 2 o'clock, and they all show up at 1 o'clock, and they all want to help, and you don't have room for them to help. You want them out of the way. So having some stuff out there for them to eat, talk to each other, at least stay on the other side of maybe like the bar, if you have a divider in your kitchen would be great. And then the other thing is then they show up like an hour late. How do you hold the food warm? Those are a couple things I want to hit today. But Ken, assuming we've got much better audio from you now, for people that maybe are just joining into the show for the first time, can you give a little bit about your background as a chef and a cook?
Mike, is that better?
You're perfect.
Perfect. All right. Yeah. So, I've been a chef for damn near 25 years, trained in, real personal chef stuff. I ended up moving into more of the catering world. I've been trained by some of the best in the industry to handle up to project management and kind of design of events up to 50,000 people, which is can be substantial, but it's been a great career. Through along the way, I went to school, got a certificate in brew science or brewing. Ended up becoming a certified sommelier of wine and spirits. I'm fully credentialed, basically in all spirits, including cigars. Even in the States, it's legal, cannabis as well. I'm working on pipe tobacco right now, and I've written for several food and wine magazines throughout the years. Speak at beverage and food conventions, and last year, I decided I wanted to learn how to make commercial cheese, and so that was something fun. And now this year, it's butchery, and so I'm sure I've missed something along the way. I'm fully advanced in all like tastings, and I help a lot of whiskey makers blend their own whiskey. The professional, whiskey brands blend their own whiskey. But I just enjoy my career. I enjoy teaching, and I think you nailed it yesterday, where I learned early on that I just school is great, but going in and being an apprentice and just learning from the ground up is almost the most honest and most genuine way when someone says, "You never did that." And I'm like, "You don't understand the blood, sweat, and tears that went into my career." And
Yeah.
that was the one thing that a lot of people were saying, at the TSP workshop. And it's humbling because they go, "How do you know so much about everything?" And I'm like, "It has been a long, long, long career." But I'm excited. I love what I do. There's not a day that I don't enjoy what I do. So.
All right. Well, as we get into Thanksgiving, let's start off with the big thing. Let's talk turkey for real. And let's start off with kind of what I alluded to. When, pray tell, if that person has a frozen bird, and a fresh would always be preferable, but you got a frozen bird, when does that bird need to be coming out of the freezer and why?
Well, depending on the size, realistically, I'm taking it out tomorrow. Tomorrow, if I'm looking for Thursday next week, I want to make sure that it's fully thawed. I don't want to have the issue is if when you're rushing it and you think somehow you're going to be able to thaw it, rush it in the oven, you have a lot of water that moisture that's just in there that really screws up the cooking process. So if I'm looking at anything really 12, 15 pounder at this point, it should be coming out tonight or in the morning. And that's kind of what the first thing that I wanted to talk about was, it's not the day of, it's what can you be doing today? And that should be, you should be cleaning everything, your fridge, your ovens. I mean, you need to start getting ready for this to make it as easier as possible. The day of is not the day
to start going through all your leftovers in the fridge and finding space. You need to start cleaning the fridge now, seeing what's good, throwing out all the bad stuff, seeing what you know, containers you have available to you. And that includes even your coolers, because you and I will get into that later. Pans, your grills. Thanksgiving Day is not the day to be doing that. So,
agreed. I'm also for pre-gaming as many things as we can during the coming week. And that leads us to, so, you know, we're going to end up with our turkey thawed through this weekend, because that takes, like, you don't take a 20-pound turkey and set it on the countertop and let it defrost at room temperature. There's all kinds of pathogenic crap you're farting around with there, especially with the way that some modern poultry is processed. Mm-hmm. So we're going to get that bird thawed over the weekend, and that's because we're going to brine it. Now, you and I were talking about this last weekend at my place. We have two different schools of thought on it, though I like both methods, but you're a wet brine guy. So what's your process for brining a bird? And start out, help people out with, why do we brine a turkey?
So there's an osmosis effect that happens when you brine anything, and usually it needs to have salt involved in the process. What happens is the salt will penetrate this, it'll start pulling out moisture from that skin. But what happens is everything in life and food science and everything, it needs an equilibrium. So as it's pulling stuff out, eventually it will find an equilibrium. It'll actually start pulling in more of those flavors that it's got around it to kind of offset the loss of liquid that's being done. You can do that with liquid. Usually what I end up doing is I'll take my turkey. Now, it's funny, is this year I think I'm going to adopt your way. I want to try your way to see how it works. But in the past, basically, I've just taken a nice salt brine. I'll usually put a little bit of vinegar or something in there, not a lot. And I'll put some aromatic stuff. It depends on what I'm brining, but some herbs, usually dried. I don't go overboard. Usually salt is my main proponent. Mm-hmm. I don't have my ratio in front of me, but basically what I do is you're looking at, let's put it this way. Our big debate is we both feel they work well. It's just wet brining a huge turkey is a space luxury. And a lot of us don't have the space in the fridge, and you need to keep it chilled. And so, you know, usually what I end up doing, I have a nice ice maker here, a professional one. I get my Yeti or a big cooler, and I make my brine, and I submerge that sucker in there, and I throw ice in there. And I know it's going to keep cool, and I kind of offset the ice with the liquid and the salt ratio. But Jack is absolutely right. And we talked about it on Monday, on Sunday, that it takes up a lot of space. And sure enough, we've got some work here in the house. And my wife said to me as soon as I got back, are you pulling that damn cooler out this year and brining? And I was like, maybe not. Maybe I'm going to do the dry brine. So I think I'm going to do the dry brine like you suggested. And I think it'll work out fine.
It works pretty well. When I do wet brine, I usually go right about a cup of salt to a gallon. Yeah. That's kind of my thing. And I like you said, to add some herbs and aromatics in there. One of my little things I always toss in a wet brine is star anise.
Yes.
And it's very subtle in an animal that large, but there is something that it does. I'm probably going to stick to doing my dry brines. I've done both. I like both. The thing with a dry brine is it's pretty easy, because you can take like a bus tub or something, put your rub down turkey just in a spare refrigerator or something like that. You don't need this big honking thing of wet brine. But I do like the wet brine method, because I think you get a much better kind of a equilibrium brine, which is what you're talking about, which is that salt is going to pull water out, and then you're going to end up with an imbalance, and it's going to start pulling stuff back in. One of the things I like about a dry brine, though, is you end up with a really dry skin, and that helps you get that golden brown. And my brine is super simple. I have a big bed full of sage, and I go out and just pull fresh sage off, big giant handful, kind of eyeball it, take about an equal amount of salt, throw it in a food processor, and whir it. And any other flavors, herbage you want in there can go with it. I spread that out on a sheet pan, and I let that sit there for like a day. And what that does is pull some of that, because it's fresh sage, it's not dry. Yeah. It pulls that moisture out of that sage, and it basically turns it into sage salt, like just an herb salt. And I'll just rub the bird with that and put it in the refrigerator and let that sit. I'll do a 48 hours on that is what my target usually is. And I'll shove some like underneath the skin and all too. But that brings me to another thing. Like what I started doing a few years ago, and I'm probably going to keep doing this, is I basically break my turkeys down. I go to two leg quarters, and then I de-breast the carcass, and then the bones are used to make stock or something for somewhere else. And the reason I do that is you can make a perfect turkey whole, and it looks beautiful. I agree. But when you really think about it, like you have the dark meat, like 160, 165 is kind of your target there. Your white meat, 150, 155. And then there's this weird animal, right? It's got like thin down here and thick there and a giant breast here. And I'm trying to, you know, so that actually works to your advantage because we can get that bird to about 165 on that dark meat and about 150 on the breast because of that. But it also like different pieces cook at different levels. And by doing it parted out, what I'm able to do is put a probe thermometer in each quarter and then cook that. And then as each quarter comes to temp, and you can do it with instant read too, pull it, then I wrap it, and that's where my Yeti comes in. I throw all my parts of all my turkey in a Yeti cooler, close it down, and I can wait 2 hours for my guests to show up, and that turkey's still screaming hot. It never goes higher. It might have a little carryover, but it's not going to overcook in there. And once it's all locked down, it's good. It also helps me because we were talking, my family is big time dark meat eaters. I have like two like white meat preferential. Everybody wants the dark meat. So I usually buy like four extra drumsticks or something and cook them the same way. That way there's a ton of dark meat. What are your thoughts on cooking a whole bird? How do we do that and not screw it up?
So, you know, cooking traditional, it looks great on the table. Let's not kid yourself, but you run into a couple of things and we'll talk about this in a little bit. Most people who are doing this aren't necessarily skilled at certain things like carving a turkey and like doing certain things. The day of Thanksgiving is not the day to learn those sort of things. And so, listen, if you want to do traditional, I will urge you to go to YouTube University, pull any one of them. The tips I will tell you is, and we're talking about the cons of wet brine. You're absolutely right. I have to take almost a full 12 hours to set that out in the fridge to air dry, to completely try to wipe down all the moisture that's been in there, because otherwise it ends up steaming, and that's not necessarily good for a good like crust on the top, right? So what I do for a traditional is I need to make sure that skin is super dry, and if you're dry brining, that's super easy. But I actually brown my bird first, right? I'll throw it in the oven as high as I can. And I will watch that sucker brown. And what happens is, as if you were to do, most people do the converse. They'll cook it and then they'll try to brown it afterwards. Well, what happens is that you have tons of moisture being released after the cooking process. And it's tough to eliminate the steam to not get a good crust. And so I will go as high as I can. It'll probably be for about 30 minutes. I'll get a really good looking brown crust, and then I'll back that oven down. And I'm all about you saying, always preheat your oven higher than you need it. That is a massively good tip. And in this way, you are already starting super high. You brown that sucker off, and then some people will cover that breast with foil. I don't do that. And I'm going to tell you something that gets a lot of chefs, a lot of people really upset with me, but I don't really care. After I brown it, I don't cover any breast. What I do is when I don't even baste. I am an injector fan, and I always will be. I take a little bit of like half cup, one part stock and one part butter and a little bit of aromatics or whatever fun, funky stuff I want to do. And I am only injecting the breast. I don't go into the dark meat. But what I'll do is I'll take the bird. I'll carefully open up the oven, put it on my stove, close that oven. Right. So as I'm cooking, basically that oven is getting back up to temp. I'm not going to lose that much temp off the bird. You got to understand, the dark meat is almost bulletproof. It's the white meat that I'm trying to save. And by injecting, I am saving that process. And so I'll squirt a little of the, you know, two or three squirts and I'll put like garlic or I'll put like paprika or whatever fun ingredient I want to do in there. And I'll squirt it in. I'll open up that oven. I'll throw it back in and let it keep cooking. For me, that has been the most, it's been the easiest and most beneficial way to keep that breast meat moist. And the benefit too is you end up, after it's cooking for several hours, all of that liquid, some of that liquid will end up in the bottom of your pan, and it makes nice dredging for some different things. But that's how I do a whole traditional turkey. And there's a lot of haters out there who tell me, you shouldn't be injecting, you're losing moisture. And I'm like, if you, it, I agree. If you do it right, if you do it right, and I use butter, right? And so butter, man, that those fats stick to that inside of that turkey and you cut into it and people are like, this tastes so rich. And you're like, you're eating basically a pound of butter in that damn breast. So, but it's delicious. Right. And so that's kind of how I do traditional
with my breast. I don't, like you said, I don't do the dark because if you screw up dark meat, you either undercooked it or you incinerated it.
Right.
Right. It's very hard to mess up the dark meat part of the turkey. But I'm like, I had the injector up on the screen just for a minute. Or this is kind of what you need. I have links to a bunch of stuff and it's almost like I knew you were going to talk about that or something. Right.
We didn't plan any of this.
Yeah, we didn't plan any of this, but it's kind of like, I knew he was going to say that because he's a chef and that's what chefs do. Yeah. On the basting thing, I have never been a big baster, and the reason is if you baste a turkey, it's like water on the duck. Like, you baste it, and it just – what do you think you're accomplishing? Like, that skin, if you have that nice brown on it, and it's designed to keep things out in the first place, like, if you put water on your arm, does your muscle get wet? If it does, something's wrong. Like, you have a problem as a human being. Something's not working right. So why would we expect that basting – is going to keep the breast moist other than trying to raise the humidity, which is already being raised because that cast off is making the oven humid in the first place. And then people are like, why can't I get my breast crispy? Well, cause you keep wetting it. Right. So inject it and brine it and you're not going to have, and then don't overcook it and you won't have that problem.
Yeah. Yeah. The other way I've done in the past, it's really great on the grill or smoker, is I'll spatchcock it, which is basically removing the backbone.
Yep.
Now the only thing, you're more than welcome to do that. Again, I think I have one on my website, if not just YouTube it, but the only thing I say about spatchcocking is you got to be careful, with a big bird, it's obviously, skin, it's raw. They're not the easiest to handle, and if you're not used to handling something like that on a cutting board, it can get a little precarious. And so you've got to cut the backbone out and then push it down. And so you're either using a big cleaver or you're using shears, which usually kitchen shears in most kitchens are not that sharp. And so you end up mangling it. But if you can do it, I do think spatchcocking has its place, especially in like, if you're doing it on a grill or you're smoking it, it does create a real flat, even surface.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some benefits to it, but this year I am trying something different. Is I'm actually going to be sous vide my turkey. And we talk about technological differences and changes in the last few years. I know I've been messing around with sous vide for well over 10, 12 years, but I think now the community now is becoming more accustomed and more like familiar with sous vides. I'm going to be sous vide it, and I'm going to be cutting it up into sections and then vacuum sealing it with my herbs and aromatics, butter and whatever I want. It'll also let me kind of do different versions of the turkey on the same bird, which is kind of nice. I've kind of figured out my times. I'm basically going to set my sous vide around 145, 150. I'll take my breast about 4 hours. And my thighs about 6 to 7. I'm thinking of it like almost like a shank, right? A shank from a deer. I want to render out all those collagens from the dark meat even more. And then I'm going to end up ice bathing it, which is a little key, difference. But with all that butter in there, I want all of that turkey to soak up all of those juices and then coagulate inside. And the best way to do that quickly is an ice bath. And the best way about this is that I can do this about 2 to 3 days in advance.
Absolutely.
And I can just keep it in those cryovac bags and it's just going to get better. Like those flavors are just going to get melded in there. When I'm done, and I think the day of what I'm going to end up doing, and actually I might end up, see how it goes. My wife's going to keep me busy on Thanksgiving, but I might show some people online if I'm doing this. Pull it. I'm going to let it sit out and dry, come back to room temperature for about 30 minutes. I'm going to make sure it's nice and dry. And I'm either going to, I haven't figured out which one I'm going to do yet, but I'm either going to do it in an air fryer or throw it on the oven and just toast up my skin as well as I can. My goal is to hit those numbers, 150, 170 with the carryover temperature. And honestly, that turkey should be bulletproof. It should be moist and just perfect. And I've never done it in a sous vide. But I want to give people the confidence. Don't be afraid to try something different, right? Like, like you're going to have fun with it. If anything, your dry meat's always going to be the fallback. The breast is really what you're concerned about. But I'm telling you, man, I'm thinking about doing one with like this, like truffle butter one with like on one, and then doing one with a traditional sage and some different things. And it allows me to cook the turkey in several different ways on the same bird, which is kind of fun. So
that's cool. Now, I'll give you some thoughts on it. Number one, I love cooling. I don't care how it happens, but cooling down any meat you've sous vide long term like that after, before you sear, because it's so easy to blow your temperature over, even if you sous vide at a lower temperature. So go back down, and then you just bring it up to it. Like you're nuking the outside because you want that crisp, but the internal temperature, you just need to bring it up to serving temperature, and you're good because it's already cooked if you do it that way. The other thing is, though, like when I say I part my birds out, when I say that, I mean I'm taking my two breast cutlets off boneless, and I'm taking my leg quarters. Just basically, you run the knife down that seam, you pop the joint, and you take that plus the oyster, and that comes off. Now you've got a carcass. Now, the reason I do this is I'm with you on the pregame. So then I take my wings also off, and the wingtips are useless as far as to eat. So the tips come off the wings, and those six pieces go get cooked. I'm going to use my pellet smoker this year, but you can do everything I'm going to say about that in an oven, right? Because a pellet smoker is basically an outdoor oven that can smoke. But then I take that core and those wingtips, I throw them on a sheet pan, salt and pepper in the oven at like 425 degrees until they're brown. That goes into a stock pot. That makes my stock. That makes my gravy, which means I can make my gravy on Tuesday.
Yeah.
Right. And that's just all you, gravy reheats just fine. And I don't like gravy out of a jar or a packet. And because I'm parting my bird out, I get less of those pan drippings to make gravy with. So that's one side of it. But again, the other side of it is having those individual parts. I like what you're saying is, yeah, I could marinate one of the breasts one way and one another, or I could inject one way and one another. I really never thought of that before because my family's not the most adventurous people with culinary stuff, which is miserable for me because I am. So like a truffle butter breast, that sounds delicious to me, but what is that weird taste? That's called flavor. Like I'll put it this way. Like I love my daughter-in-law, but she's nitpicky as shit. And a couple of years ago, I did just basic, boring, everyday stuffing, but add celery and onions and use broth instead of water. That's kind of like how far I went with it to keep it easy. She's like, well, I like it, but I don't like the onions. Bullshit. She doesn't like looking at them.
Right.
Because the next year, I just took the onion and I threw it in a food processor and I made it into basically onion mush. And I cooked it into the stuffing, which made it taste exactly the same, but she couldn't see it. Thought it was wonderful. So she wasn't there picking out little individual onions. But like, I guess that's a little hack. That's like a baby. You mash the food up and they can't see it.
For sure.
That's another thing you can do. But I do love the take apart approach because you get so much more control and then you can make that wonderful deep broth and use that to make your gravy.
Well, let's talk about gravy for a second because I'm going to piss off some more chefs about this. Okay. But again, you know, I think you're capable. I don't really know, you know, everyone's talent out there, but making stock and gravy is not the most easiest thing to do for some people to do it right. And so, you know, this is the Survival Podcast. And I the way I kind of focused this kind of notes was like, you know, if you have the talent, then you probably don't even need me talking to you. But if you don't, I would say, honestly, better than bouillon turkey base is the best way to go, right? You just, it's almost, again, foolproof. It's good quality. It tastes well. You can still use the drippings from your turkey, especially if you're doing it a couple days in advance and throwing it into the base. So you're not like it's almost like this hybrid where you're just using it as a flavor stacking. And then what I want people to start getting used to, and I've got my notes here. I'm going to try to put all this stuff by the end of today or tomorrow on my website to make sure people know. But I want people to start getting used to a roux. Roux is half one part butter, one part flour, and you melt your butter down. Use unsalted butter, and you put the equal amounts of flour in there, and you whisk over medium heat. And there's three stages of it. You can do a blonde, a brown, and then a dark one. And basically you're just cooking the flour in the butter and it ends up being almost like a paste. And that is what a lot of chefs use when you're making a stock. It's called a velouté, right? And so they will add roux to the stock to thicken it. And so, you know, I always add a little bit of stock to the roux to start off with to get a nice slurry, and then I'll end up adding more roux. How much roux do you need? It's about a tablespoon to every cup of gravy that you want or stock that you have. So if you're making about 4 cups, you're using about 4 tablespoons, kind of good judge that when you're doing your roux. You can throw in, you know, 4 tablespoons of butter, 4 tablespoons of flour, whisk it up. You've got about, you know, so it's, I want people, and if you guys are ever interested, you can always reach out to me always about tips and stuff. I'm always available to you guys, but I just prefer to leave it, keep it simple, stupid, right? If you're not advanced enough to do your own stock, that's okay. But just use ingredients that the chefs would use to save time in your average kitchen. Better than bouillon is a staple in my kitchen. So,
yeah, it's at T-Spaz. You can find better than bouillon. It is probably, and if you have a Costco membership, they sell the big giant ones for less than the little bitty ones at the grocery store. Just another thing. And so that is a fantastic, and I use it as a cheat all the time. If I'm doing like leftover beef, and I'm going to throw it in a little mini crock pot and make a stew, I'll throw a teaspoon of that, the beef in there. It's fantastic. On the roux, one of the things I learned from Michael, who's kind of our head kitchen guy during our workshops, is he always makes a bunch of roux for the gravy, and he makes way more than we need for the workshop. He throws it all in a Tupperware pan, throws it in the refrigerator, lets it get kind of solidified, mm-hmm. crumbles it into a Ziploc bag, chunks it in the freezer.
Yep.
And then whenever you need roux for thickening something, you just reach in and grab a handful of it. And I don't use it a lot because it's flour and carbs. By the way, we're not even worried about freaking minimizing carbohydrates for Thanksgiving. It's freaking Thanksgiving. Shut up and eat, right? Mm-hmm. Like that's where I'm coming from today. But so I don't have to make my roux this year because it's sitting in my freezer. And I will admit a little bit reluctantly that it kind of tastes good to eat frozen.
It is. It has, I mean, it's
a little caramelly, buttery.
It's butter and it's, what do we say? What society ever had an abundance of fat and carbs at the same time? Like yeah. it's just it tastes so good. There's a piece on Drink Eat Learn I did last year. It's called basically What the Hell is Giblets or and. If you don't know how to cook organ or neck or different things, again, Thanksgiving is not the time to experiment with this. Just no. Keep it simple. You know, if this was a podcast for advanced cooking people, I'd be like, all right, let's have some fun. But let's just keep it simple, all right? Let's not. My goal for Thanksgiving is for you not to be so in the kitchen that you are missing out on family time. That to me, that's the best part of Thanksgiving. And sometimes you can get people to help. But I'm with you, Jack. If I've got, you know, Aunt Kathy in here messing with me, I don't, that's not, that just causes me issues. So
yeah, I agree. Now I will give you a use for the neck that's really kind of cool and doesn't really help your guests at all. It's for you, the cook, right? So I always take the neck. Hopefully you get a good, you don't get that little nub of a neck that you get the full neck. And I'll throw that in a pot. And I'm already using some celery and carrot and onion for aromatics with the turkey anyway. Get a little stock pot, throw a handful of celery, carrot, and onion in there, some salt, throw the neck in there, and simmer it, right? Now, there's extra broth. Do whatever you want to do with that. Like, oh, I don't know, use it when you make your stuffing. And you do that. I do that first thing in the morning, on Thanksgiving morning. That neck goes on the pot simmering, and let it simmer for an hour or so until it gets super tender. I pull it out, throw it on a plate with some salt and pepper, and I sit down on the couch when I'm taking a break, and I eat it, and I share it with the cat. And it's some of the best meat on the turkey. It's something people mock or they don't understand. And I think it goes on like my Italian grandmother taught me a lot about the kitchen and how to cook. And that was like her thing is she ate the neck and I got the little skinny piece and she got the big fat piece. So I eat the big fat piece. And since nobody else here wants it, like the dogs get everything all year round. The cat sits down with me and shares the neck as a break. And you get extra, get extra broth out of it, which let's move on. I think we've hit turkey pretty good. If there's any questions, y'all ask and we'll answer. We're chill today. We're not in any super rush or anything. But let's talk about stuffing. Now, I usually make 2 stuffings, again, because I have this non-adventurous segment of the family, and then I have me. And so I'll make a stuffing that could probably be its own standalone. The basic stuffing I do for the family, because this is what they like, again, celery, hidden onions for the daughter-in-law. I use chicken broth, and I just buy the big giant like Pepperidge Farm cube stuffing and follow the directions. And that's for my my hack with that is when I'm done with it, it goes in a pan, it goes in the oven, it bakes to the top crisp a little bit, and I cup a bunch of little cubes of butter and kind of space them out almost like they look like chocolate or like white chocolate chips on top of it. And that makes a beautiful kind of like brown to the top of the stuffing. And that's all I do for them. What are your thoughts on kind of like ordinary stuffing? Is that what you would do? Would you do something a little bit more enhanced? Or
so for my ordinary stuffing, I use a blend of challah bread and croissants.
Okay.
Challah bread to me, it doesn't get as soggy. It's a little more forgiving. It's egg based. It's a little more forgiving in the stuffing. I use croissants typically. I'll tend to mix it a little bit on top, and it gives you what you're looking for, that incredible crunchy, like, and those little bits of flakes of butter and flour that are real thin. I do the same thing as you. I'll cube up a bunch of cold butter and I'll put it on top. And my secret ingredient, though, when I'm doing any stuffing is egg yolk. So I'll do my broth with the turkey. I'll add some wine, I'll add some butter, I'll add some heavy cream and all of my, you know, sage, rosemary, onions, celery, all that stuff. Let it simmer in. And then when I'm done and I'm about to put the bread in, I will take two, depending on how much stuffing, I'll usually use about two or three egg yolks. And I'll just mix it into the liquid. I'm not cooking it. It's just, it adds this richness to it. Can't get to it. And actually, Dorothy gave me some duck eggs. And so that's what I'm going to be using this year is some duck eggs, which should really amplify it. And in my traditional stuffing that I do at home, which my wife hates, but it's a smoked oyster stuffing.
Okay.
And I do a really good oyster stuffing. And I'll usually add in some like, different types of mushrooms. It depends on what's fresh and available. I think this year, since we've been playing around with a lot of more of the exotic mushrooms, I'm going to play around with that a little bit. But that's typically my go-to stuffing is a challah, like a croissant. And this is a time where and it sounds real cheesy, but you know me and like supporting, like apprenticeship. This is when you go to your baker. I hate to say it. I don't go to my local grocery store to get this bread. I go and support the local bakers because usually I can get some really good bread that's usually a day old and they're usually happy to get rid of it, but I'm supporting them. And the quality in bread, I know you love your Pepperidge Ridge Farm little bag, but the quality of bread is going to be paramount. And it's going to give you, Jack, if you use the croissants, yeah. I really feel like it's going to give you that extra, like, just crispy.
No, I like that.
Dude, it's so good.
I like that, but I'm not doing all that for them, see, because I got my own, right? My own is, a lot of years we didn't do it this year, but a lot of years we have cornbread for the workshop. We have tons of leftover, and I'll just dry that out, and I use that to make a cornbread stuffing. If I don't have it on hand from a leftover from a big event, I'll just make a sheet pan of cornbread and dry that out. And that's my base for the cornbread stuffing. But I do a cornbread chestnut stuffing with sausage. And that would stand on its own. And some years I'll do like a smoked sausage, like an andouille or something. Or some years I'll do just like a sage breakfast sausage. And usually it's sausage I make. And people always say, what's the recipe? I don't do for something like your grandma made stuffing. She didn't have a recipe. I make stuffing. I don't have a recipe. Kind of a ratio of like how much liquid, you know, to the bread. But you kind of just eyeball that as you're adding it and mixing it all together. But I use these, not necessarily even this brand, but these types of, they're pre-peeled, pre-roasted chestnuts. They come in a foil bag.
Yes.
Pop them open. Chop them up and I end up being almost the only one eating this. I'll eat it for a week because it's the only time of year that I get to do it. And that's kind of like, and I also use sage with that, of course.
Yeah.
And, I do the same thing with it though. Like once it's all mixed up and ready to go, it goes in a pan. And I love those, you know, throw away aluminum pans because when you're done, chunk them out. And that time of year, you got so much crap to clean. Anything you can avoid is fine. And I just mix that together by eye. And do the same thing with the butter on the top and the bake. But I like using challah bread and croissant. I would have really never. Now I'm seeing bags of croissants at Costco that I just walked past last week in my head. That's actually a really cool idea.
So here's the pro tips, too. So number one, if you notice, if I'm doing the sous vide or other ingredients, I'm not cooking turkey really the day of. I'm just browning it, right?
Yep.
I have all my dredgings from everything done. My gravy is pretty much done already, too, on the day before. Now the stuffing, what I always do is I'll make my liquid base first the day before, but never, ever, ever, ever put your bread in the day before. Right before you go in the oven, drop all that liquid in, drop your egg yolk in, and then mix it all. What you're looking for is, like, I never want to be able to squeeze the bread that liquid comes out, but I want it moist enough that it has like a, I always call it like a little shimmer on every bit of it. You can always add a little bit more. I say about halfway through the baking if you need to. It's not recommended, but it is a labor of love. I mean, you know, it's that secret ingredient of love. You just kind of practice and know, but you will get the best crispy stuffing if you add it in the bread right before you put it in the oven. Just take the liquid out, add it in, mix it up. You don't even have to warm that liquid up. Just mix it in and then put it in the oven, put your butter on top, and it will blow your mind. Stuffing's delicious.
What about making sure, like, when you serve food, it's all warm without ruining it? Like, I got really lucky a couple of years ago. Vivor came to me and I got a bunch of stuff for free, including the big hot warmer box. So I can fit 4 full sheet pans or 8 half sheet pans in that thing, set it to 140 degrees, and as sides are ready, pop it and I don't have to worry. And that's made me kind of spoiled. Like I said, with the turkey, I do the wrap and into the cooler. And then that way, when I'm ready to serve, I just start pulling and carving, and that's worked out really well. Are there maybe some other ways that people can make sure that when they're serving that food, it's because it blows. Like, I'm sure you've dealt with it. You have family over, like, sit down, it's time to eat. Sit down, it's time to eat. Sit down, it's time to eat. Sit down, it's time. Get the kid, put the kid in it. He wants to eat dessert. I don't care. Everybody sit down, fucking eat.
Yeah.
And you're watching the temperature of the food just, and you know they're going to be eating cold ass food. And so I've done everything I can to try to avoid that.
You know, there's, I always tell people, look, if you love having that spread on the table, like that bountiful feast, just know that some of your food's going to be cold. Like, it's just going to happen, right? Okay. The pro tip would be, which is what I do, is I go to like a Smart and Final or some restaurant place. And I luckily have really professional grade ones, but I still use those wire chafing dishes. Mm-hmm. And I will use chafing dishes if it's going to be a large, large group. If I'm talking like 10 to 12 more people. If it's not, I'm just consciously thinking about oven space and the amount of space I have at my house. So if I know I've got my two level grill out top that I can just do indirect heat on, that I'll fire that one up to make sure we're good. I got my air fryer right here. I've got my oven below me. Like, and then I just count. Okay, I've got 3-4 shelves. If I put everything in half aluminum pans, like you're saying, buying, yep, I can do 11, 12 different areas of heating. And what I'll do is I'll make one 400. Usually my grill is like at 450. My air fryer is more for like just crisping things. And then my oven is at 350. So I know I've got different ranges. And basically, as soon as I feel like we're ready and you know, Aunt Kathy and everybody's piped down enough where I can wrangle them, I go, all right, guys, we've got 15 minutes of dinner. And if they don't come, that's on them. And at 15 minutes, I'm throwing everything in those ovens.
Okay.
And that way I know, okay. And then I consciously think about like mass. If I'm looking at something I don't want to dry out, obviously I'm not going to keep that turkey in there any longer than it should be, right? But if I know I've got mashed potatoes, that's probably the last thing I'm pulling, because it's not going to burn that much, and it's, if it at all, I mean, really. But and if I'm cooking something more delicate, then you just kind of have to start learning. I wish there was a better way to tell you, but really I look at mass and I look at what is going to be, what's the star of the show, and what are some of the things that, if that gets a little more brown, I'm not going to be too worried about it, right?
Yeah, so, I agree.
But there is a little bit of a Rubik's Cube game that is played with it, and it just takes some experience. But I say utilize as much oven space as you have, and then pre-plan the pans you put it in. That's huge, because if you've got a big pan for something that's kind of small, it's taking up a lot of space, it's just going to drag the next thing down the line, so.
And we definitely do kind of the serve yourself buffet line. That, to me, that makes a hell of a lot more sense than taking up all the table space and everybody's reaching around. And sooner or later, the kid's going to knock the freaking gravy on the floor, because I know, because it's happened, right? Yeah. So we have like a really big bar in our kitchen. And assuming there's enough space at the table, we don't have to seat people there. We just line it up there. And the other thing I tell people, if you don't have a natural place to do that, get yourself a cheap $20, $30 folding table from Home Depot or Lowe's. Set it somewhere where it's convenient for people to serve themselves. Throw a nice tablecloth over it so it doesn't look janky. and set, like you said, chafing dishes work really well. We have the hot box, so we use that, but they're like $300. So I don't, like, you can get a nice set of chafing dishes for way under that.
Yeah.
My niece and nephew, my nephew and his wife, I guess, so my niece-in-law, they do a Friendsgiving every year the week before. That way they don't have the family conflicts with it. And that's exactly what they do. They set up some tables, they set up chafing dishes, you know, and then they have all their sides and everything out there. And that way everything's nice and warm. And to me, that is way easier because people are getting their food and sitting down. If you notice, like, unless it's really high end, almost every large event, that's how people are fed, because it's much easier than trying to, like, you know, waiter in everything to that many people.
You know, we talked about it last year too, about, you know, not everybody has the money to do an extravagant Thanksgiving dinner. And so you don't want the in-laws to know maybe you're struggling with money. And so, for me, buffet lines are a really good way to kind of, you put your more voluminous, like, inexpensive ingredients, salads, that kind of stuff up front on the buffet line. So when they get to the more expensive stuff, they're not going to be loading in, you know, 8 to 12 ounces of turkey when their plate is so full. And so it is kind of a nice cheat to make everything look kind of stretch further if you're not buying that big of a turkey for everybody. So.
Absolutely. That I completely agree with. Let's talk about maybe some appetizers, because I really do. I literally throw people out of the kitchen.
Yeah.
Like, it bugs me. My kitchen, like, if I could fix one thing about this house, it would probably be a bigger kitchen. I've redesigned it. It's beautiful, but it's still the size and footprint it is. And when you're in there trying to work and people are like right on your back yammering, and not to you, to each other, it's like, get out. Right. And what I found is where that service bar is, if I put stuff to eat on the outside, then everybody goes there and leaves me alone, and I can be less of a dick and yell at my family less on Thanksgiving, because that's always a good thing. And appetizers do a lot for that. Now, you just kind of mentioned, if you're kind of going smaller on the main course, maybe you want to fill people up. But if you're going big on the main course, like, I like to do appetizers. Like, you saw what I do this weekend. Oh, no. I don't do that for for that big of a group. It's too much. But yeah. I do like to kind of stick to kind of the charcuterie type stuff. There's going to be plenty of starch on the table. So if people are full of bread, then I did all this work and nobody eats anything. So, you know, some cheese, some prosciutto, some stuff like that. You got any other ideas for, like, things that, in, like, you know, celery and carrot sticks, that also, if anybody will eat it, everybody always brings one to the potluck and then, like, two people eat it. But what are some things we could put out to kind of occupy people so they have something to do and stay out of the way?
Yeah, you nailed it on the head, man. Grazing is the best thing, right? And that to me is you limit the amount of time you have to replenish by just putting something out and letting people kind of serve themselves with it. Charcuterie is the way to go. I, you know, typically when I do a charcuterie, I like to do sausages. You know, I'll cook sausages and make it tends to be a little heartier. And then cheese is what I end up doing. Cut cheese is great. Like, you can get all, but people tend to forget about spreadable cheeses. And spreadable cheeses are really great, because it just kind of keeps people munching on stuff, and you can put crackers out and they're just kind of happy. The big thing I do too is, like, baked brie. It is super easy to do. You'll go out and just buy a wheel of brie at your grocery store or local cheese shop, come back, and you just basically put it in the oven on low, on like, for like maybe 15 minutes at like 300 degrees, pull it out and basically just cut into it, put a little spoon in there, and people can take their brie and just kind of spoon it on a piece of bread. Sometimes I'll do that if I really want them to get kind of hearty up first, and then we don't have a lot of food, we're just trying to stretch things. I'll do like Black Forest, little shavings of Black Forest ham, so they can put a piece of bread, Black Forest ham, and then spoon some of that brie on top. And then I'll put a little cheap jar of like apricot preserves or jam out. And it really makes this like almost like an open face sandwich that they're spooning out. It feeds a lot. Brie is not that expensive. No. And then
it's luxurious, right?
It's very luxurious. And I always tell people, when you're building your boards, if you have rosemary and herbs out in the garden, especially rosemary looks really good on the platters as like garnish. It looks very rustic. It adds this incredible smell to the room, but it's very cheap. And so
you're saying just, cut off like a full, yep. fronds of it and yep. lay it on, not necessarily to be eaten, just to be seen and smelled correct. And appreciated. Yeah,
correct. And sometimes I'll actually put them in between each meat, like the row of meat. So
kind of a divider.
Correct. It looks pretty. It adds color, but it's super cheap and it makes it look a lot more luxurious than, you know, going to the deli section and grabbing your meat. So, the big stuff though, if you want to, I think you and I will save the best for last, but, which will be deviled eggs. But, for me, like if I'm really doing something fancy and you guys really want to do fun, if you can get your hands on late summer figs right now, like it's the best. What I do is I'll take a half of a fig fresh. I'll put a little bunch of small little gathering of a prosciutto, and then I'll drizzle hot honey over the top with a little bit of crushed pistachio. Ooh. And it's like it's like one little poppers that people love. It's super fancy and it's not that hard to do. I do a lemon, rosemary, ricotta, and baked brie. So I'll take ricotta, the big jug, and I'll just put lemon zest and lemon juice in there and a little bit of rosemary dried, and I'll mix it up. And then in another dish, like a ramekin, a little platter, I basically take a little more rosemary, olive oil, and I just throw grapes in there, and I put it in the oven for like 15 minutes. And the grapes get real soft and kind of caramelized, and you basically can use that with bread, and people can just smear the ricotta with lemon, and they've got this like really nice sweet little grape on top of it, which is just kind of a really cool thing. And then I will always, because I have good access to pecans, and I know some of you guys do have on your homesteads, but I will take I'll take pecans and I'll basically put them in the oven with brown sugar, a little bit of a little butter, and I'll toast them off and get like basically a brown sugar pecan, candy pecan. And I'll make that my own little mix of nuts, but I'll put dried cranberries in it with it. And so it's a nice little pop of like cranberry, but the nice sweetness of pecans. Pecans can be expensive if you don't have any, but really any nut would do. But those are really nice little like add-on appetizers that don't take a lot of time up, because you think about the ricotta, it's just you make it early and you set it out, and those grapes take 15 minutes in the oven, and you're talking like before even the football game's on, you've got all that stuff taken care of. So now for me, you know, let's get into deviled eggs, because that is going to be a time sink, but I think from you and me, it's both worth it.
Yeah.
Again, traditional deviled eggs. I love your little egg cooker that you had on this week.
Yeah.
That helps out tremendously, because that's the pain is I usually get some of my, you know, friends, kids and everybody to peel eggs for me. And that's the penance that they pay for eating good food. But I'll just do a traditional bacon jam, traditional egg. Like, you know, I'll do my normal, you know, deviled egg thing, but I'll put bacon jam on top. If you're really going up in class, like, and I usually do this for some of my fancier clients, I'll do a sturgeon caviar deviled egg.
Ooh.
And that is, that's like over the top good. And then I'm going to give you, I haven't told you, Jack, but I'm going to give you a little, one of my favorite ways to do deviled eggs. And I don't know anybody who does it. And I'm just going to give it to the community. I take all my chicken yolks and I separate them to white, and I put them in the sous vide, and I put them in for like 150 for like, I'll get the timing on it. But basically I make basically egg yolk jam out of it, right? But what happens, Jack, is I don't end up mixing the yolk into a jam. I keep it whole, and I take the egg, the white, and I just put the yolk back in it, right? Okay. And so basically when you eat into it, it like it's not runny. It's like this, it's like this like super nice creamy, but I don't mix it up. I just put the yolk back in. So it looks like an egg with the egg yolk still on it, which is kind of funky.
Okay.
And then I'll put different toppings on it. Sometimes I'll do like a sriracha, little dab of sriracha mayo on it, or I'll do whatever I'm doing on top. But the fun that you can have with people when they're looking at an egg yolk, and I can kind of play with it because it's super, cooked, right? But yeah. I put it on that egg. And I basically
need a video of this one, dude.
I might do this one for you. When I come up, I'll do this for you.
Yeah.
But it's super fun. I think deviled eggs for me, it's like tradition, right? It's like when I think of Thanksgiving, I think of my grandma bringing deviled eggs, right? Yeah. Luckily Nicole got me a new, deviled egg tray at the TSB workshop. So I'm super stoked about using that one on Thanksgiving, but for me, deviled eggs, it's worth it. Again, you can do a lot of this stuff beforehand. You know, a Ziploc bag so you can pipe the deviled egg mixture in quickly on a Thursday when you're not having to work at it. You can honestly get the kids involved as well. Hey, can you pipe this in? You know, the added value of child labor during Thanksgiving is really good. So
quite useful. Yeah.
Quite useful.
Yeah. I've got up on the screen for the people on the video right now, the recipe that I do, with that, egg cooker review. Unfortunately, I realized I don't actually have a picture of the egg cooker in the review. But I got it specifically because I love, deviled eggs. Yeah. And I don't like peeling eggs that don't peel well. And that little cooker, they just, especially ducks' eggs, when they're fresh, they don't peel worth a damn. And I don't always have eggs that have been around a while. So that cooker solves that problem. But there's so much you can do with deviled eggs. Bacon always makes everything better. It certainly makes deviled eggs better. But you mentioned the sturgeon caviar. There's a place, I can't think of the name of it now, but I really love the place down in Lake Clear Fork. Clear Fork is where this is in the southwest side of Fort Worth. And they do kind of like low country Carolina style cooking, really upscale place. And they do a deviled egg appetizer and it's piped about, you know, an inch and a half high with golden trout roe on it.
Oh yeah.
And that is freaking off the hook. There's a million things you can do with it. Like you said, you don't need fancy piping equipment or whatever. Ziploc bag, cut the corner off. And whatever doesn't come out, just toss it back out.
I've been experimenting with. I'm going to see if I can make a biltong like jam, like a biltong, like cut my biltong up and like put it, a little bit of like sweetness into it. I'm going to play around with it this year. I'll see how it goes. So I might drop. Okay. I'm up your area next week anyway. So I might drop some stuff off. So
you got me thinking bacon jam on a deviled egg. That's
the best.
But so some other things with that, like you mentioned, and I'm glad you did pecans. And when I was talking about the cornbread stuffing, the other thing I've done if I, you know, flaked out because I don't just have chestnuts around, chop pecans in stuffing, period, is good. Of course, again, my non-adventurous family, why are there nuts in yours? Because they taste good. Whatever, fine, I won't put it in yours. But another thing for like an appetizer or a dessert that you can do with a vacuum sealer, specifically a chamber vac where liquid's not a problem. Dice up some watermelon, and you can do this with other fruits too. Pears work, a couple other things too. And then put some kind of spirit in there with it. And then vacuum seal it, and then leave it in the refrigerator for like a day.
Mm-hmm.
And with watermelon in particular, it's so fluffy, I guess. It's got so much air in it. It really compacts it. It changes the texture. And like one of the really great things to use is like a Grand Marnier or like a Grand Gala. And you don't need a lot. I mean, maybe it's a shot into the whole bag, like an ounce and a half, 2 ounces of it. And it gives this amazing flavor. And I mean, I don't know how people feel about kids, but like if they eat one piece of that, they're not going to be drunk off their ass. They might take a nap and shut up for a while. That would be good. But it's an incredibly flavorful and different texture. And I forgot all about that until you were talking. And I'm like, maybe I'll put out some spiked watermelon or spiked like pears and brandy. Like is another thing that like the whole texture changes because you're compressing the air out of the fruit. It's denser and you're forcing that spirit into it. And you could use something else. It doesn't have to be alcoholic, or you could use something really mild with alcohol, but you want some other additional flavor that complements. Pear and brandy obviously complements. Grandma, you're looking at like that that orange citrusy thing contrasted with the sweetness of the watermelon.
Right.
Really, really cool thing you can do. And that, again, that keeps people out of the kitchen. And then I have to yell at them because I do. I'm like, out. And they're like, oh, no, I'm not freaking kidding. Get out. Yeah. Like, there's no room in here. And the problem is when you let one in, it's like the camel's nose in the tent.
Yep.
Everybody's in. Like, no. Once one's in, like, they're all, you got to get out. Are you cooking? No, out. So let's talk potatoes.
Yeah.
Let's talk potatoes. Mashed potatoes. This is the one I don't do. My wife does it. She's good at it. So I leave it alone. What do you do?
So for my mashed potatoes, man, I do something kind of weird. I do something called Chantilly mashed potatoes. You ever heard of that?
No, I have not.
So basically you're making, I'll go through a little more detail in a second, but basically you make a regular mashed potato, and there's some tricks I can show you, but in the end, I don't add my cream hot. I whip my cream into a hard peak, like I'm making whipped cream for like a dessert. And then I will take my mashed potatoes and I will fold the whipped cream into it. Okay. And then I'll usually add in like that Gruyere that I got, or the cheese I got you with the caraway,
yeah,
or Parmesan. I'll mix that in a little bit. so it doesn't collapse it. And then I'll put it back into a roasting pan and I'll throw it back in the oven, and it basically crisps the top and it makes the most fluffy, incredible, cheesy mashed potatoes that you've ever had. Mm. And that's typically what I do for mashed potatoes, because I get tired of the regular mashed potatoes. I can make some really good mashed potatoes, right? I've got, there's a blue cheese mashed potato that I do that's incredible. You know, a truffle is like one of the truffle oil and that kind of stuff is a classic. But when I pull out the Chantilly mashed potatoes, and that recipe I will have on my website by the end of tomorrow. I make sure I got today. I'm really busy, but I will make sure I have that on tomorrow. But if so, people want to try it. But basically, you're just boiling the potatoes. Now, the other thing that I do for my potatoes that no one else does is, again, I go back to the better than bouillon. I boil my potatoes in stock.
I do the same.
And a lot of people, they don't do that. And it blows my mind. If there's an opportunity to flavor stack.
Yeah, yeah.
Then I'm going to do
that's
it.
That's the one interference that I do with my wife when she's making the potatoes. I'm like, I got stock. Here, use that for water, and then you can do whatever you want. Because that's such an easy thing to do. Anything you're using a liquid to cook with that's absorbative, put flavor in the liquid.
Yeah. The other thing I do, too, is that once – so I basically peel my potatoes, chop them up, put them in the water, boil them until they're like fork tender. When I drain them, I actually put them back in the pot for a little bit because I want more of that moisture to evaporate out. I want less. It will help your potatoes in the end get less like gummy and mushy. So I'll just leave them in there. I'll kind of stir a little bit. It's going to be inevitable. They're going to break up a little bit, but I'm just looking low heat, evaporates more of that moisture. And then when I'm ready in that same pot, you take cold butter, use cold butter. If you use hot butter, what happens is that you're running the potential that you're separating both of the milk fat and everything in there. Cold butter, when you're melting it in the potatoes, it emulsifies on its own. Mm. And you don't have to worry about separation. So using cold butter is the key. Use lots of butter. I mean, that's like the key to it. Salt. I just usually do salt and pepper. I don't get fancy with seasoning with mashed potatoes. And then I whip the amount of heavy cream that I would normally put in the potatoes to make it rich, I basically just whip into a whipped cream without sugar, obviously. It's just whipped heavy cream. And then I fold it in with some cheese and rebake it. It's delicious, man. It's delicious.
Like I said, I kind of stay out of that because it's the one thing my wife wants to do. And she does basic everyday, you know, cream, potatoes, butter. Yeah. She does use cold butter, but I do the stock. I also usually throw a couple handfuls of garlic in when she's not looking because why wouldn't you do
why
that?
Why not?
Too, right? Like, why wouldn't you?
What I will tell you is this year, because I am going to be trying some of your stuff, because I just love the way you cook. You think like a chef. I am going to be doing your smashed potato recipe.
I was going to go next. Yeah,
it's a must. I keep hearing about it, and I'm like, I got to try this. So.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to explain next. So what I'll do is I get like fingerling potatoes, and I'll cook them until they're about 80 to 90% done and let them cool down. And then I mash them until like the sides puff out. And then you give them a good coat with like, you know, salt, pepper, garlic, and oil.
Yeah.
And or bacon grease or what have you, and throw them in the oven and just bake them till they're crispy. And I used to do just kind of a standard roasted fingerling potato to go alongside it, and nobody ate them. Everybody ate the mashed potatoes, giant pile till they couldn't move, and then maybe they eat one. Now they make those are like crack. Like, and now you always do rosemary on them because rosemary and potato just are beautiful. And I've done them with like the multicolored fingerlings, and I've done them with the browns. And I think the browns come out better because they crisp better. But like the red, purple, and brown mixed together looks really cool, and everybody digs it. And that's a super easy thing to do. And that's just a kind of food chemistry thing that when you cook a potato and you let it cool and you cook it a second time, you get a crispness out of the starch that you can put it in until it turns black. If you don't do the cool down and second cook, you'll never get the crunchiness, the crispiness, the browning that you can get doing that. Like same with a French fry, right? You fry it. Take it out, let it cool, refry it. You get a totally different experience than just fry it longer.
Yeah, I am super excited about it. I heard about it. You know, you told me about it a couple of years ago, and I was like, man, like this is, I got to try this. So I'm excited on that one. But I recommend if anybody else wants to try this Chantilly, check out the website and we can.
Get that up, and I'll make note of it tomorrow or something on the show so people don't forget, because that sounds really cool as crap. Somebody just asked about this, and usually we wait to the end, but I plan on talking about this anyway. What about cranberry sauce? You know what I don't like? I don't like the shit that comes in a can. And it's almost like people put it on the table because it's expected, and then like maybe one weird fucker eats it, right? Like, I am not a fan of that stuff, but some people do love it.
So last year on my website, I wrote an article that said I effing hate cranberries. Now I understand, food scientist kind of thing. Like, cranberries have this thing called malic acid. It's tartness, right? And so you've got such a heavy umami based, like fat and just carbs and just everything. You need something to kind of refresh your palate. And we'll get into this other part later, but you should be using the drinks, alcohol, things other than cranberry sauce to kind of change your palate and kind of refresh your palate. But I do my own non-cranberry slaw kind of thing that gives you the same malic acid you usually get. I basically cube up like Granny Smith apples, a dash of apple cider, a little bit of sugar, cinnamon, ginger, fennel root, and pomegranate seeds. And I mix that up. And then at the end, I take some of those fennel fronds and I shave them over the top, so I get a little bit more of that anise kind of flavor to it. Mm. And I put that in the fridge overnight, and then I pull it, and it gives a really nice like textural. It's got a nice crunch to the apple, and there's a just earthiness to it, but it's also kind of tart. That to me is a really nice palate cleanser to have on the plate. Mm. I did add on my notes here, if you really want to do a cranberry thing. What I've done in the past is I've taken the traditional cranberry jelly crap that you get in the cans, and I get half cranberries, and I cook those cranberries in that jelly. I just put it into a pot and let it cook down a little bit to make it easy on myself. I take like 3 or 4 tablespoons of marmalade. Okay. That gives it a little bit of sweetness, but it also gives it a little bit of that orange punch, because marmalade has the orange rind to it. I chill it, then I pulse it. I put it in a blender. Just blend that sucker, and it basically I'll put it on the table as like something you can spoon out. And so it's something that I put this way. It's something that I can tolerate, because cranberries to me can be kind of pungent. That adding the fresh cranberries to the jelly does help, and then adding the marmalade with those orange bits in it, it gives that balance that I think cranberries. I've never been a fan of cranberry sauce ever. So
really.
Uh-uh.
I actually like it if it's real cranberry sauce.
Yeah.
It's super simple to make. I just buy the cranberries that come in a bag this time of year, the Ocean Spray or whatever. And whatever the directions say about how much sugar and water to cook them in, I do that. Here's my two additions. I matchstick up an apple, right? And like a sweet apple, because the cranberries are already tart. So like a Fuji or something like that. So I matchstick up one apple, and I get a small can of mandarin oranges. And once the they don't need to cook long. So once the cranberries are doing their pop jelly gooey thing, I throw those in, mix those in, and then chill that down. And I put that out on the table. And that's another one. Like, my family's not that adventurous. So the one negative with that is you can't buy like a cup of cranberries. They come in that like 2-pound freaking bag, or you don't get them at all. So I always end up with extra. But to me, it's, I like that tartness, but I like what you did too with that. But, It's something that if you do want to make it, it's so flipping easy. And again, I don't because it's on the bag. Whatever the bag says to do, if you don't do any of my extra stuff and you just do that, it's so much better than that cranberry jello in a can. I don't understand why anybody eats that shit. It's not good. And it's really not good. I don't know any redeeming characteristics for it. Now, what you said, okay, I get that. You could throw out some real cranberries in with it. But then if you want the cranberry experience, you know, come up with whatever bread recipe you want and throw a cup of cranberries and a cup of walnuts in it.
Yeah.
And then be pretty damn good. That's dessert, right? You know, with that in mind, before we move on to desserts and beverages, do you have any other, like, because everybody does like the green bean casserole, which I know, green beans and bacon and done. That's for me. I don't do the onions and the canned soup mix. But we usually do corn, potatoes, stuffing, turkey, gravy, and then anything else is gilding the lily. But that's like the core for my peeps.
I got some sides. Yeah, I do like green beans, but typically what I'll do is I grill my green beans. Okay. And then usually the day before I'm making a brown butter. So I'm taking like 4 or 5 pounds of butter and I'm putting it on the stove and I'm just letting it reduce down. Basically all the fats, the milk fats caramelize, and you will know when it smells. Again, YouTube University, because I could sit here and try to tell you how to do it, but it just takes practice. And then I will, once that's done, I will take most of it out. I'll leave some in, and I'll toast almonds in that liquid. And then I'll clean that out, and I'll do another brown butter where I'll cut up a crap ton of shallots, and I'll make crispy shallots. Mm. And so when I'll go out and do my green beans, I'll grill them off, and then I'll basically drizzle a little bit of that brown butter on top, toasted almonds, and I'll top it with crispy shallots. So people are still getting that old casserole kind of funk to it, like with the crispiness to it.
Yeah, but it's good.
It's good, right? It's good. The other thing I do too, and this is all air fryer because you can't replicate it really in the oven, charred Brussels sprouts, and I use dried cranberries with that.
Yeah.
And typically I'll just typically do bacon. I'll chop up some bacon, throw it in there with the charred Brussels sprouts. Usually I put my Brussels sprouts face down so they get real caramelized, and then when they're done, I shake them a little bit. And then when I'm done, basically I'll drizzle them with a little bit of balsamic, not too heavy, and dried cranberries, and I'll toss those. Those are a crowd pleaser. I roast in the oven carrots with tarragon and orange zest, and then I'll drizzle it with hot honey. Okay. So it's kind of this hot, zesty, kind of fun carrots, but I'll do whole carrots. We'll move into desserts in a second, but two of the ones I usually do that's really fun this time of year, it doesn't really take as long as you think, but I take sweet potatoes, I cut them in half, and I put them face down on the oven. And I basically bake them that way. And then when I'm done, I could take them off, and they're basically have their own canister to kind of spoon in, right? I'll take some whipped cream, not the same one I'm used for the potatoes, but a whipped cream that's a little sweet with goat cheese, a little tart, and I'll pipe it in there, and I'll pop on some pomegranates on top. And so people can basically grab a sweet potato and kind of spoon like this. Other people I've seen too, is they take that same sweet potato. I minimize sugar, but again, this is Thanksgiving, so I'm just going to give you the idea. Basically take brown sugar on top of it and take a torch and like creme brulee the top of it. So you've kind of got this creme brulee sweet potato thing, which is really fun. Mm. And then the other thing I try to incorporate too, just because I love them and I get a lot of them because a friend, I do a lot of roasted beets.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'll roast beets and I'll add a little bit of feta to it and then some toasted pistachios.
I love that. And if you can get them, the freaking golden beets are.
Oh, dude, they're insanely delicious, man.
I prefer them to red beets, and they don't have the bleeding red stuff everywhere. They're just really tender. Unless you grow your own, they're really hard to find sometimes. But yeah, the golden beet is underrated as hell.
I think your safflower, I think that would go really well with my roasted beets. And I've been wanting it looked gorgeous. And so those are some of the sides I do. Again, they're pretty easy. Reach out to me if you have any questions on them. I don't know if I'm going to add recipes for them because they're pretty simple. But reach out if you're interested. So
one of the things I like about sides is that's where if you have the boring family of Dutch heritage like I do, like white rice is like a thing for them just by itself. You can make like one adventurous side, and then people have the crap they want anyway, and then maybe they'll try it, like, you know, just out of a sense of obligation, and you start expanding their food horizon. I am glad you mentioned the dried cranberries, because when I mentioned the bread, I don't use fresh cranberries in the bread. Use the dry cranberries in the bread, because I didn't say that, and that's what I meant. But walnuts and dry cranberries in bread, or pecans. Like you mentioned pecans earlier, like, pecans and cranberry in a like a rustic bread, that's pretty badass. So I guess before we go into desserts, one thing I would say with bread, like even if it's like pop in the oven dinner rolls or something like that, that is one thing personally I never pre-cook. Like that is the last, like everything's ready to go on the table. The breads, like especially like the either croissants or like dinner rolls or whatever, go in the oven and they come to the freaking table in a bowl and they don't go in the what do you call like the buffet line. I put those right in the center of the table, nice whipped butter next to them, fresh hot out of the oven with like a tea towel over the top of them so that they don't get too cold. And I usually do like two different ones in two different bowls.
Yeah, you know, I think the one thing I think you and I were chatting about it a few weeks back is that, guys, it's okay if you leave let your butter get room temperature. You're not gonna die.
Please.
So typically in the morning when I start getting stuff ready, I will basically pull most of my butter out unless I need some cold. I'll leave in there, but I'll pull most of my butter out just anticipating that it's going to be ready for dinner, whether you're having it at noon or 6 p.m. It'll be okay. It'll be okay for sure. The other thing too is, you know, I forgot what you're talking about. Oh, the bread.
Yeah.
You know, if you have fresh rolls that need to be baked from dough, plan it accordingly, but most of you guys are going to be using, you know, store-bought rolls that just need to be reheated. My guide is when everyone is sitting down at the table, because
bread goes in.
Yeah. Because no matter when you think, oh, it's too late, it's not. You've got Aunt Kathy that's going to be complaining about something, and you know, you still got to do, you know, prayers and all this other things. By the time everyone gets their food and you bring out this like basket of bread that's just super warm, oh, it smells great. It just sets the mood. It's perfect. So,
yeah. And I'm looking it up right. Fix. That's what it's called. I didn't even find it, but I remembered it. It's FIXE is the place I was talking about. This kind of the upscale Carolina low country stuff. Next time you're up here, you should totally, maybe we'll go there together or something. It is badass. And breakfast is the thing. Their bartenders are arrogant in a good way as well. The way I found this place, I was with some friends. Dorothy and I went out with them for dinner, and we're done with dinner. Like, we have one more drink for a nightcap because I know the place to go. We walk in this place about 11 o'clock at night and ask the bartender, can you make a good old fashioned? And he's like, I can make a perfect old fashioned.
Oh, geez.
And I'm like, okay, let's, and he did. Finger. It was like the little singed freaking orange peel and everything, you know, so it was like, and it was perfection.
Nice.
But then we tried them for breakfast, and that's their philosophy with biscuits. When you go for breakfast, do you want biscuits? Yes. How many people? Yes. The timer starts. There's no such thing as a pre-made biscuit at that place. When they bring that freaking biscuit to you, if you cut it in half with a freaking butter knife, when you put the butter knife in the butter, it falls. It's so hot. It falls through the butter. And that I like that fresh bread thing. It's never as good as it is right out of the oven. That's when it's at its peak. And I don't see anything wrong with like family Thanksgiving using store-bought rolls, pop can. I don't care, whatever it is. Mm-mm. Like, if you want to make them yourself, go ahead. You know what? Fresh bread out of the oven, even when it's like that, nobody cares. And I don't like doing a lot of work for people that don't care. That's why, like, the apps that I put out this weekend when you were here, like, I don't do that for them because they don't care.
Oh, that was like, that was like,
they don't care, right? Like, they just don't care. So why am I going to put all of that, like, for people to just slam food and don't even, you know, and I'm not being mean or anything. That's just who they are. And there's nothing wrong with that. I'm a little proud of this one. So I'm going to bring this up. This is the apps that I had out, this weekend for folks that came over. And it was, The top line right there, that's like an homage to a bagel. So it's a bagel crisp. It's a cream cheese with black pepper and chives. Then it's smoked salmon that I made. And capers and safflower petal. That was pretty badass. The middle one is a cashew rosemary crisp with pepper jam, beef bacon, cured egg yolk, and fennel flour. And then the bottom one was like a fruit and walnut crisp. Ken's caraway Havarti cheese, and Iberico one. Iberico is a Spanish pork that is like the best in the world. A sherry vinegar, pickled celery, and a little hot honey on the top. Like, I'll make that for people who are going to sit down and eat that and be like, yeah, man, this is great. And they like taste all the flavors and everything. I'm not doing that for a family that's going to come in, jaw jack, and get drunk before we even eat and just shove food in their face on Thanksgiving. So store-bought rolls, that's what we do. We do the ones – we do whatever my wife buys. I'll put it that way when it comes to that.
Yeah. I want people to spend more time with their family. I really do. Like, don't be ashamed of that you're not, you know, making your bread from scratch for Thanksgiving. You know, take the edges where you can, take the advantage where you can. I mean, this is Thanksgiving. I want you to sit down and relax, you know.
Yeah. And if you want the big rustic loaves, go to the grocery store, get the ones that they make, you know, do that Wednesday. Throw them in the oven for 10 minutes at 350 and warm it up.
We'll segue, because I know we're headed that way anyway, because it's the perfect one, is into desserts where, listen, if you want to experiment making a pie, make it 3 days in advance. Don't make it Thanksgiving. Don't make it hard on yourself. How many pies do I make as a chef? Zero. I don't make pies. There are people out there who make really good pies, and this is again where I say go to your local bakery, not a grocery store, go to a place that actually makes some really good pies they're known for. Spend the money, take the time, give the quality, and give back to these hard, you know, pastry chefs that are doing this stuff in the kitchen. And pick up some bread, pick up some rolls at the same time. But you know, for me though, being able to do a good pumpkin pie, I just don't want to deal with it 3 days in advance.
No.
And I sure as hell don't want to deal with it the day of.
We usually have a pumpkin and an apple. We buy them at Albertsons.
Yeah.
I mean, I like your idea of a good bakery, though.
The one dessert that I do on a regular basis, and I do get the kids involved because it's super easy, is I'll pre-make a base for a cobbler.
Okay.
And then I'll basically have the kids like warm it up again, get it thick again, then pour it into the pan, and then get the puff pastry, and then they can, you know, sugar it and butter it, and they have fun doing that. It gets them out of my hair, but it makes them feel like they did something.
And I
don't mean to be a jerk. That's how I got into cooking, was with my grandma.
Yeah.
But I've got I don't babysit with people in the kitchen, and I'm probably not as patient as my grandma once was. But if I can do that, then they can be proud of something that they put on the Thanksgiving Day table. And that to me is big, because when you get kids involved cooking, it's usually under chefs that want to deal with that, not me. But but when you get them involved, it makes it more of a family thing. And so for me, the quintessential dessert that I always put on the table is cobbler. It's easy. I can throw it in the oven while people are eating. Right. I can just put the stuff in it, lay it over the top. It looks good. I throw it in the oven, and the bread, usually it's the bread coming out, the cobbler going in, and I'm sitting down.
And when you say puff pastry, you mean it's something you can buy at the grocery store. It's in a wrapper. You open it up and lay it out.
Right? Lay it out and just done. And just, I usually egg wash it, a little sugar, cinnamon thing, I'll shake on top, and then just let it brown in the oven. By the time that's browned, the inside temperature of that cobbler is done. And you're good to go. And it's a great, and then you're basically pulling it out. You're letting it sit. And when people want it, you can either reheat it, or if people want it, then they can have it. Then I don't give a crap. Buy good ice cream and you're good to go. Cause some people like to have dessert right after meal. Some people like to sit on their meal afterwards and let it like linger and then eat. So it's just, it's easy. Again, buy your pies. You know, if you want to do cookies and whatever, do it 3 days, 4 days in advance. Like it makes life so much easier in the kitchen. So that's kind of my dessert thing. So,
and you can always warm stuff up. I do have a dessert. I haven't done this forever, but I actually learned to make this in freaking Boy Scouts. We used to make this in a campfire. You could do it individually in foil, but I do it just in, again, throwaway aluminum pans. And what's nice about this, you can pre-make it. And like you said, when everybody's eating, you throw it in the oven and it's done and it's fresh and it's super simple. You get apples, whatever kind of apple you want to do this with. You cut the top off nice and level flat. You take a coring tool, but you don't go through the bottom. You take the core out, you know, you make a nice round hole in the center of the apple, and you take soft butter and brown sugar and you mix it together about equal parts. Throw a little bit of cinnamon with that and shove it in that hole of that apple. Set the top on it, set them in a pan, throw it in the oven at 350, bake them till they're soft.
Oh,
that's the whole freaking thing. And then when you bring them out, either throw good vanilla ice cream or like a sweetened cream on top of it. And it's like apple pie a la mode with no crust.
Yeah.
It's stupid simple to do. And if you have a good vanilla extract, maybe drizzle that over the apples before you lay the tops on them.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
That's all you got. Like, we did this when I was a kid in school and in Boy Scouts, and you just wrapped it in foil and set it at the edge of the fire. And I was like, one day, like, if you could do that, then why can't it go in the oven? And that's, you know, everybody gets their own little apple, or people that want half of one, you cut it in half, and it's stupid easy. And it's again, it's one of those things that, like, okay, every single morning I thought, turn the oven off. It's fine. It'll be warm. It's good. If you need to warm it back up, you're not going to ruin it. It's not going to overcook. It doesn't have a crust to burn.
Yeah.
You know, you can throw foil over to keep it warm inside the oven.
Sounds delicious.
No one ever complains. The kids usually eat around the peel. They leave the peel, whatever. That's fine. You know, and that little piece of advice I have for parents, people in general, when it comes to kids on Thanksgiving, let them eat the fuck they want.
Mm-hmm.
This is not time for a nutrition lesson. And I think a lot of times parents that aren't even that hard on their kids about what they eat, when they go somewhere else and they're in front of people, they want to eat your vegetables, make sure you're not, fuck that shit. Like, just sit down and enjoy your food. Right? You know, nobody tells an adult, hey, eat your vegetables when they're shoving stuffing in their face. It's a shove food in your face day for everyone. Let it be. Don't pick an argument that you don't have to have.
There's already going to be enough.
But not on Thanksgiving.
Yeah, there's already going to be enough arguments about other crap. You don't want to about food, so for sure. So
I made it. Let's see what this is. I made impossible pie. I threw a few ingredients in a blender, put in a pie pan, and bake. It's custard pie. The crust forms while baking. Okay. I have no problems with that. And then this person says apple cake. Wow. Somebody had said something. They have a recipe from their grandma on apple cake. And I've never been a big pie person because it's so sweet. Cakes are my jam. My grandma used to make like an apple crumb pie. Oh, like a bundt cake with like the good coffee cake crumble, cinnamon crumble on the top. Man. Oh.
Yeah, look, I'm not taking away from any of you guys out there in the homesteader world that loves doing baking and I can do all of that. I just Thanksgiving is not the day for me to work too hard. I'm trying to get as much as I can, 2 to 3 days out. If there's something that it's a family tradition, you guys know, you guys listened to my recipe segment. I hope you guys did. I'm all about family legacy and tradition and carrying that stuff on. Please do that. Like that is something that I remember from my grandma, and I wish I still had those recipes, and I was too much of a knucklehead not to remember them. So please share those. I don't want you to feel like this is a segment that's like, screw that, go to the store, buy stuff. Like if you love baking stuff, I urge you to. It's just for most of us out there, don't try to experiment and learn something during the week of Thanksgiving.
Agreed.
It's not the best time, and you're not going to impress anybody. Maybe you will, but odds are it's not going to be like you turned out, especially baking.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're going to try it this year for the first time, make it this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And then either save it or now you know it's good. Now you know how to make it again and you make it early. Like don't try radically different things the day of, no matter, especially with desserts and baking. Because I say I don't use recipes. If I actually bake something, I use a recipe because we've moved into the world of chemistry. When I'm, you know, cooking a lamb leg or something, I can eyeball it, right? It's easy. When you start making a dough and you want it to rise, or you want it to not rise, or you want it to brown, or whatever it is you want it to do, all of those things require precise measurements and precise procedures. Some things, you know, as you know, like the dry team and then the wet team comes in and stuff. And that's part of why I don't do it. I don't like fussy ass shit when it comes to cooking. I like really high quality ingredients and really interesting combinations. But if I do want to bake something, then I'm going to look up how do I do this? Because I know if I eyeball it, you know, unless it's bannock on a stick, I'm probably going to blow it, right? Like, that's about all I can pull off. Let's talk about, because you're a Somme, right? So let's talk about some beverages here. Like, wine's a big thing for the table. The kind of go-to is the French Gamay's, like the Louis Jadot. Villages, right? Like, yeah, right? That's like the, because that pairs really well with the cranberry and the stuffing and the turkey. But it's also like an also-ran that everybody does. What are your thoughts on like a good table wine?
So, you know, I love Beaujolais. Beaujolais, obviously this Beaujolais, there's two types of Beaujolais. I don't want to get too into this, but Beaujolais Nouveau is a very fruity, fresh wine. There's also Beaujolais that's standard Beaujolais that's a little more heartier than normal. But it, for me, I I'm keeping it simple. Even as a Somme, I do boxed wine tastings, right? And so I will tell you, you know, there is nothing better than just a good Sauvignon Blanc and a good Pinot Noir.
Okay.
You can find a lot of great value in wine, and here's the kicker with this question that you're asking me and the answer I'm giving you. Most people are going to be like the people you're saying. They're going to come in, they're going to drink whatever the hell you got.
Yep.
They're going to like it and they're going to enjoy it just because they're getting a good buzz and they're happy. If they care enough to have pairings, they're contacting me personally about different vintages and stuff. Now, the takeaway I want you to think of, though, is think of one. I want you to think of a white wine. I know, you know, previously Riesling was like the topic, and Riesling is not always sweet, and so you can get a dry Riesling that can throw off your entire meal. I do want to introduce people back into that world of Chardonnay, and those that don't like those buttery Chardonnays, there are Chardonnays out there that don't have butter, buttery malolactic flavor, is Chablis. If you see Chablis anywhere in the world, in the supermarket, in the grocery, wherever you are, Chablis by law has to be unoaked. So you get this really cool expression of like Macintosh apple and stone fruit and acidity without that like big buttery taste. And it's a really cool thing. You kind of impress people when you come in. Oh, I got a Chablis. I'm fancy. I'm from France. But I think Chablis is probably one of my favorites. Reds, I'm sticking with Pinot Noir. Really something from Oregon, even from something from Santa Barbara are going to give you good choices. You can even head back into Burgundy. But I think, again, keep it simple. If you find, like if you're going to a specialty market, like a, you know, Trader Joe's or something, not like your regular, mom and pop market, and you end up getting a boxed wine, I'm okay with that.
What's your preferred brand? If you just don't know nothing else about a person, but I'm going to give you a boxed wine brand. I'm gambling here. Because there's no way I can possibly do this as fast as I'm going to do, but go ahead.
There's a boxed wine called From the Tank. It's okay. A weird one. They actually bottle both of their Northern Rhone wines in box and in bottle. And I've done like tastings with masterclass tastings where I'm tasting people, and I decant both of them and I ask them which one they like better. And odds are that it's about 70-30 split where they like the boxed wine better. So it's kind of a
mass market though, right?
Like, yeah. Honestly, like if I was choosing, my wife really likes Black Box.
See, there's no way I could have possibly bullshitted that one. That was instant.
That was right on time. Yeah. I'll tell you why. You got to remember what. Wine is a commodity, right? And so if it will spoil. And so what happens with some of these boxed wine places, they'll buy wholesale grape juice on the open market, and they're going to, for lack of better terms, I don't want to scare anybody, but chemically make sure that it's going to taste consistent across year to year. There's no vintage. They're not doing anything weird. They're just saying, okay, we need some more acidity. We're going to add more of this grape juice. There's nothing. I mean, there is some outlying things that they can add in there. That's the whole other topic. But for the most part, you got to remember the people that are coming to this are just going to want something that they can get a good buzz to. It tastes good and it's consistent. If you're really trying to wow people, go buy a bottle of Prosecco, right? Do some bubbles. I mean, that's fancy, but you have permission from a sommelier to say, you know what, go buy some boxed wine. Now, if you do want some more specific pairings, reach out to me. We can have some crazy fun with that, but keep it simple with wine. You're not a wine person. And even me, I get inundated with all the selections. I just keep it simple.
Yeah.
I keep it simple. Now there are some drinks that I'm going to mention to you that we did last year that I want to mention again. Is there is nothing better than walking into a house that has mulled wine or wassail in the crock pot. It sets the mood for the holidays. So remember, wassail is basically like apple, orange, cinnamon, and there's cranberry, and you're basically just making a spice cider, basically. Now I do it virgin. I don't add the alcohol in, and then basically allows kids, if they want some, you could ladle some out. Again, it's a grazing type beverage, right? Yeah. It's a punch bowl, active, warm, smelling, delicious punch bowls. People can come over. You have some cups, you know, paper cups over there. They ladle it in. If they want to add some brandy in, they can have it on the side or whatever. That way Aunt Kathy can get drunk, and then, you know, little Bobby's fine. The other one,
would be the spirit you'd put with it is brandy, or
probably brandy. Yeah. For me, brandy, just cause brandy is a distilled, fruit. Yeah. And so I kind of just want to, and you can also add in, let's put it this way. Let's say you put all the apples and everything is in there and everything is just brewing steeping really nice. And you've got all this like star of anise and cinnamon there. If I added apple brandy, and it doesn't have to be expensive, and just had apple brandy on the side, it's just going to flavor stack that even more appley flavor, right? I've seen other people do like Rumpel. right? So they're adding that, like, the cinnamon kick to it and everything. And
yeah,
typically I just stick with brandy. And then you can do something like mulled wine. You could add a bunch of wine into a crock pot, put the same spices that you would in apples, you know, the orange, the cranberry, the apple, put all, and you're basically just mulling wine. Typically I wouldn't add, I would probably add more of a port to that, but I stick with Wassail. Apple, there's nothing better than warm apple smell with cinnamon and star of anise and like nutmeg coming into a house, and you're like, oh my gosh, this is the holidays. This is just that and the sage from the turkey, forget it. You're setting the mood, right? And so, and then lastly, if you guys haven't already, I think that's going to be my topic this week, but you guys need to get started on your eggnog. It's starting. You know, I like to age mine. I brought Jack a really good one on Sunday, and but you should be making your eggnog now so that you've got some through the holidays, through Thanksgiving, and it will last, depending on how you make it, it will last all the way through Christmas. So,
and if you guys use Chef's recipe on it from last year and you get your proof up high enough, it'll last a year. Because I've got a quart jar of it in my refrigerator now that he made last year, and it is freaking fire. So I would tell you, if you're going to do that, make a double batch and age one. And then you can start making a batch every holiday season, and you're always at a year of age, because it's pretty cool. And we did have some doubters here, and they did kind of freak out when they heard eggs, cream, you know, a year. But I think it's like 25% alcohol.
Yeah.
And then you're like, if you think about it, like what is Irish cream liqueur?
Yeah.
Right. And then that nobody freaks out. Like you open it, once it's open, you put it in the refrigerator. And if it's 6 months old and you're adding to coffee, nobody has a heart attack.
No, I use the rum that I gave you. It was an 18-year rum. I think it was floating around 130. It was potent. And I pushed this one a little higher to 25% alcohol by volume. And you go on my website. I think I'm going to end up doing the segment again on it. But if you can verify that you're using the correct amount per volume, you can ensure that – and again, guys, this goes back to like fermenting and just stuff 101. If you open it up and it smells like sulfur and it's don't drink it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, the first thing I did, I opened it up. It smells delicious. I'm going to give it a little taste. It's incredible.
Amazing.
You know, like – no one has had, very few people that I know have had eggnog that's been aged 1 year.
Yeah.
And it was probably one of the best things that I've ever put my hands on. And so super happy to give it to you as a gift. You're right. I think this year what I'm going to do is I'm going to make a bigger batch. And what I probably am going to do is make enough, like almost a gallon or so of it, that I'm going to bring it to the fall workshop next year.
Okay.
And that way the guys, everybody, all the people at the workshop can try it. And then do another couple of gallons, one for me, one for my, you know, it just, I'm going to be an eggnog factory over here in a little bit. So.
All right. It's good. Like, and it is something to do during the holidays because it's so much sugar and sugar and booze together. Like if you really want to wreck your system, do too much of that. It's when you drink eggnog, people think of like big glasses of it and shit. When we're drinking this, we're talking like, you know, a couple ounces at the most and you sip it and you enjoy it. And on that note, I've got one that's kind of a shot. And so this is not something to get your family completely liquored up on. But fortunately, they started making this stuff again because they stopped making it. This Godiva white chocolate liqueur. There's also another brand called Celtic Dream that has a white chocolate. White chocolate is necessary for this. Like your Irish creams and all will not do this as well. And it's stupid simple. You want high proof peppermint schnapps and this. And your shot is 50% of each.
Oh, yeah.
And it's a white chocolate peppermint like. It's like a dessert and you can shoot it like a shot. This is another thing though. You can sip this. It does not have, this is not a frat party. And it's kind of like a dessert without a dessert. And it's also a booze. And I was pretty happy when it came back last year. I bought the last bottle they had like 2 years ago at the liquor store down there. And it was this Indian couple that owns the place. And the guy told me they weren't making it anymore. And the woman started flipping her shit on him. Right. His wife said, we sell so much of that. He's like, I didn't do it. Right. And when I left, they were still fighting over it. So I guess somebody wrote Godiva enough letters and they're like, yeah, you know, when nobody buys the chocolate shit that we kept and everybody wants it. And that was always the case. I'd go in and like, you know, the chocolate liqueur was like stacked all the way to the back and there'd be like one or two bottles left of the white chocolate. And they stopped making it. But white chocolate and hot, you don't want the low proof. You want the high proof peppermint because the white chocolate liqueur is like 20 proof or something, 24 proof. It's like 12%. It's like wine. So you're going to bring it down with that. So that hit, and then you put the white chocolate liqueur in the refrigerator and the high proof peppermint, like Ice 101 or whatever, in the freezer. Cause it won't, it ain't going to freeze. It ain't going to freeze. Real quick. What about maybe some, more adult, quality, like a whiskey, sipping with, Uncle Dan or something at the end? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. I think this time of year, most people are considering like bourbon or and what I would lean toward is rye.
Yeah.
To me, rye has a little bit of a spice to it versus where bourbon's good. I mean, you guys are going to enjoy bourbon no matter what, whether it's Thanksgiving or a Tuesday on in March, right?
Yeah. So,
you know, I will say to everyone on Thanksgiving, try to expand your palate a little bit, right? If you don't do rum, you know, try some Caribbean rum, Jamaican rum. Again, I think, you know, you and I just had a damn near 40-year port on Sunday. Ooh. Port is always a good way to start moving into like a more of a stronger spirit that's still in the wine world, and it's delicious. It's like figgy and oxidized and raisiny, and it's so nutty. It's so interesting. And if you have it with like cheese or even just dessert, again, if you're not taking shots, it's small sips. And so for me, port is kind of that gateway drug into, if you don't like any of the harder stuff, port is usually where you want to be. So,
yeah, I like yours originally was a 20-year tawny, but it ended up being a 40-year tawny because you have more willpower than me. You kept it around that long. But like for brands like Optimus 20 or Optimus 30, like both of those are fantastic. Expensive, yes, but this is not, you don't give this, like you said, Aunt Kathy doesn't get a glass of this, right? This is a little tiny snifter, and you're drinking maybe an ounce and a half of it very slowly, having a conversation with people that appreciate, like I wouldn't even share that with the people that wouldn't appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Right. When I start dropping $50, $60, $80, $100 a bottle on something, like I'll share it, but only with someone that's like, I know what it is and I know what I'm looking for with it. And so I didn't really think about port for that, but that's a good recommendation. That's why we have people like you on the air. This has been fun, man. Let's take a couple questions and I'll cut you loose so you can go back to butchering ibex and deer. And we got some comments here as well. Maybe we've covered them. I just, anything with the follow the rules, I put a star on. Comment from Packrat, timely recommendation, relatives too weak to handle the weight of cast iron skillet. The synthetic nonsticks are hopefully mauled. I guess he's talking about the pan recommendation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't like Teflon coated shit. I don't. That's why I like the carbon steel pans. Mm-hmm. And if you've never checked out Morton and Stork, dude, check them out. They're pretty high quality. I don't think we need to say anything unless you got some bad.
No. Carbon steel all the way.
Question. Have you talked about cranberry sauce? Yes, we did. So we're through that one. Next. Do you add celery root to mashed potatoes? And my answer to that was no, but I'm gonna now. That sounds like a pretty cool thing to do, either celeriac or celery root.
Yeah. There's some recipes that just call for just celeriac. And so I'll add celery root once in a while. I'm going to be kind of just dated here. I get kind of bored of mashed potatoes a lot.
Yeah.
I actually will add more celery root when I'm doing my keto is when I do cauliflower. And so I'll boil my cauliflower down until it collapses, and I'll basically do the same thing, with my cauliflower, but I'll add some celery root into it. But for me, I guess would ask is what would be the reasoning during Thanksgiving to add it? I mean, for me, most times people, it's the added benefit or the novelty. It isn't going to come across to most of the,
cause everybody's just friggin'
pretty much.
Yeah. What I do with celery root is I'll cube it up, a little oil and salt, throw it in the oven and roast it.
Oh, yeah.
And then I'll put that into like a beef stew. Normally I don't eat potatoes, right? So it's much lower in carbohydrate, which is what you were inferring there. And if you roast it first and you only put it in at the end so it doesn't go to mush, it's a pretty good stand-in for potato. I've used radish that way too, like just cherry bell radishes. It's amazing. You cook them and all that radish bite just goes away.
Yeah.
They kind of remind me of like, not like a good brown potato where they have that good, but like more like a red skin or something when you do that with them.
Yeah.
Okay, this is just a comment. I think I'll put some crispy sunchoke and shiitake on deviled eggs. I'm not going to complain about that.
No.
That sounds pretty good. Of course, you got sunchoke and egg yolk. Yeah, they only do that if they're not spending the night at your house. And some people know why, and some people, I don't get it. You'll get it. Try it. Top comb, how best to save leftovers to make another meal later?
Yeah, I didn't want to drag this out any further, but I want to remind you guys that I love having leftovers. That's the best one of the best parts. Now, when you're running into have so much food that you're wasting, you've lost money and that's not good. And so I did a whole thing on it last year on a segment on it, but you know, you can go back and listen to it, but basically you got to remember if it's bone in, you're looking at about a pound and a half per adult. Right. And so, and then if it's boneless, you're looking at more of a half pound to three quarters of a pound. So when you're looking at like potatoes too, like serving size is roughly 8 ounces. And so a good ratio is a half a pound of potatoes for makes 1 cup of mashed potatoes.
Okay.
So, you know, you can kind of start buying things a little more smartly. Again, I urge you to go back to that segment that we did last year on it. You know, leftovers for me, it's incorporated in different ways that I talk about one last year for the kids that I do like this, like Thanksgiving Day pizza kind of thing where I'll take dough that I make in house, but you can buy like, you know, your frozen dough and stuff. And I basically layer it with like gravy and then mashed potatoes and then turkey and then some of the sides on top. And then I put it in the oven and the kids love it because they can eat. But you're getting rid of a lot of those dessert sides. You know, freezing stuff helps too. Like if I know I've got stuff that it'll hold, like I have a ton of gravy, I'm probably going to freeze that and save it for Christmas.
Yeah.
It's not the best, but no one's going to know. It's Christmas and it saves things here and there. And then you'll probably see me eating like turkey sandwiches throughout the week, like pre-batching stuff, or I'll make like a pasta and I'll throw turkey in there. And, the big thing for me though, too, is at the end, making a big soup out of, or a stew.
That's what I do.
Right. Out of like all of your green beans and your carrots and your, all this, and you throw your meat in, you amp up your stock a little bit, your turkey, and then hopefully it'll be cold soon and you'll actually feel like it'll be, autumn and you can eat something hearty. So
the nice thing with that too is I do the turkey soup thing. I don't do as much as I used to because of the way I part the bird out now, but I used to roast the whole bird. You take that carcass, you make a soup out of it. You just break it up and throw it in a stock pot, make a huge pot, take all your leftover celery and carrots, like you said, whip that in, you make a big thing of turkey soup. And then, you know, you kind of wear out on turkey leftovers, right? Yeah. So then take the soup and part it out into like, you know, Tupperware and freeze it. Because soup freezes just fine. And then when it does get cold, you pull out that, you know, and then you have that Thanksgiving flavor at that point. Now, I have not made this ever in my life, but my grandma's big leftover after Thanksgiving was turkey a la king.
Oh.
And you take a big piece of crusty bread and you toast it and you put that down and that white turkey a la king on top of it. And I don't even think I've eaten that. Other than the shit they call turkey a la king in the army, and it's not, okay? It's not since my grandma made it. But if you know how to do that, that's pretty badass right there. Let's see. You can do a turkey hash too. A turkey hash using the leftover stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I got to put my head around that and go see what I can come up with. I tend to let cheese warm before use as well as butter, although keeping an eye on it during a long holiday afternoon in the house, overly warm for visitors is a good idea. I think he's talking about making potatoes because you said to use cold butter. I'm not sure what he's talking about. I will say on the butter thing, bro, we do not keep the butter that's being used in the refrigerator at all. I know you have some food handling like stuff and rules and stuff, but for me, like when that stick of butter comes out, it goes in the butter dish with a lid and it stays on the freaking counter.
Mm-hmm.
And we never have butter around long enough that that's a problem. I don't know how long it has to be that way, but I would encourage people to remember what butter came from.
Mm-hmm.
It came from farmers who had milk and more than they could use at one time, and they took the cream and it was more cream than they could use, so they figured out, you know, how to make butter. And then when they made butter, they put salt in it, they pressed it, and then it lasted longer. And did they have refrigeration? No, they did not. It's not good. Like, and again, dairy and eggs. I don't know anybody ever got sick on it unless it was mixed into something else and went bad. Like if you have pure dairy or you have pure egg, you are not going to freaking eat it if it's been the second you open it. Nope.
Oh God. Yeah. Yeah. On his with his cheese thing, I think what he's talking about is just leaving cut cheese out on the charcuterie board. What I will tell you is cheeses with higher fat content like sheep's milk, they sweat.
Yeah, that's not good.
And when they sweat, they can tend to get mealy, like kind of grainy. So if you want to do it, use it like a cheddar, like a whole milk cheddar. Those are good. But yeah, I would stay away from sheep's milk. But
Okay. Yeah, that also has a big function to do with the temperature of the house too. The colder the house, the less that's true. Like when you do stuff like a porch day, like we did last weekend, like cheese sitting outside, like it's very, very quick if it's warm out, then it starts to degrade in quality. Okay. I think we got one more and we'll let you go here, Ken. Question. Can you recommend a good cider appetizer with a good wine pairing for Thanksgiving?
Yeah, I mean, for me, anything that's kind of apple-y, I know my apple slaw kind of thing, I end up doing, I'll do things like Jack does. I'll add these little like crackers on top and I'll do like an apple with prosciutto and hot honey and a little bit of nut. So I've got texture, sweet, crunch, like that. But then when I do anything with apple, I am looking, to like a California Chardonnay or Sauvignon Blanc. You got to remember when you get to a warmer climate, the more stone fruit notes if you're listening, you're a Psalm, don't butcher me on this because I'm going to make it as simple as possible and I'm going to be blurring the edges. But the hotter the climate, the more stone fruit is more pronounced. So you're going to get more of those apple, apricot kind of things going on. Mm-hmm. That is like a perfect – if you got a Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand, they're going to be a little more acidic, a little more tart. I don't necessarily like that pairing too much for Thanksgiving. I like the heartiness, the warming, and like the stone fruit kind of essence that you get out of California Chards and Sauvignon Blancs and a bunch of other wines too. Please, I'm really smoothing the edges over on a very detailed answer, but
I would say like your layup for that is before the meal even starts, right? It's very the cheese board. Right. Get it depends on what you like. Like you said, like a Chablis where you have like the apple-y thing going on without the butter oak toast thing. I like the butter oak toast thing, but whatever wine you're going to serve, like especially you're going to like have when guests show up and you want them out of the kitchen, you're going to pour some wine for them and send them off. Like sit down with the cheeses you have available and you yourself just try the wine with the cheese, try the cheese and then the wine, try the cheese and then the wine, then the cheese in different orders. And you figure out what works with it. And then just recommend, hey, when you have your wine, try it with that cheese first.
Yeah. Like for instance, that baked brie that I said you should do with all the little fruits, doing a Chardonnay that Jack likes, one that's kind of oaky and buttery, man, that is the perfect pairing. Because if you think about it, that is like a triple cream brie that's been melted down and you've got this like buttery kind of thick Chardonnay, especially from California, like Russian River Valley. Like, man, those two buttery things just kind of they're like, it's like chef's kiss kind of thing, right? So
take some pecan pieces, throw them in the oven and toast the pecans and put them on the brie and then put a Chardonnay with that. Holy shit.
It's all right.
Now I want to do that now. Anyway, man, thanks for being with us today. Let people know how they can learn more about you, man.
Yeah, so if you guys know me, I'm still the Blood Sugar Chef. You can reach me at bloodsugarchef.com. And then I haven't been posting much on drinkeatlearn.com. It's been kind of my health has been more of a forefront. But during the holidays, I know you guys want more stuff from there, so you're going to see some posts on there. Those are really the ways you can reach me on my websites, drinkeatlearn.com, bloodsugarchef.com. And then the best way right now is on Telegram. If you guys have the Telegram channel, that's like direct access to me. And I'll always do my best. I mean, obviously, I'm busy. But if I have time and I see an at, man, I will pound that away and make sure that you are make sure that you're well educated as much as possible. Tryptophan is the chemical.
Yeah. Jesse's asking, is there a way to process the chemical turkey that makes you sleepy tired? It is tryptophan. So Mythbusters did this and they came to this conclusion. It's not the tryptophan. Mm-mm. It's the 40 pounds of food you stuff in your face. So what they did, they made up two plates in two different days of the exact same food. Turkey, stuffing, gravy, the typical, you know, quadrant of Thanksgiving. They had a normal size portion one day and nobody was tired. And then the next day they ate like a mega portion and everybody was ready to pass out. So All you got to do there is
I make a comment about it. I mean, I'll eat a turkey sandwich and I'll be fine. Yet on Thanksgiving, it's like, hey, what I say to you, enjoy the nap on Thanksgiving. And that's a part of Thanksgiving. Don't feel guilty about it.
Build the nap in. That way nobody fights. Everybody sits down and watch football and takes a freaking nap.
Yep.
You know, I have this giant nephew named Andy, and I remember one of our Thanksgiving, like one of the Thanksgiving was like a holiday thing. And we had these meatballs that were pretty badass, and he had like this huge plate of them, and he's like in the recliner sofa eating meatballs, and he literally passes out. There's like four meatballs left. He slept for like 30 minutes. He wakes up, and he's like, since his head's like this, he's looking straight at the meatballs, and he like wakes up and sees the meatballs, and he just gets this giant grin, eats the rest of the meatballs, and goes back to sleep. When people are sleeping, they're not arguing, no stress. Feed them Chardonnay, feed them turkey, give them a nap, and everybody will be everybody's less cranky after a nap, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Ken, thank you for being with us today, man.
Always a pleasure, Jack. I love having you guys. Thank you so much.
All right, guys, real quick, it was great that we had Ken hang out with us for almost 2 hours there. I just want to remind you guys before I sign off today that I actually do have my book, Laws of Life by Jack Spirko. Marked down a little bit on Amazon. We marked down the hard copy, I think, $3, and then we marked down the Kindle version like $1. So I don't know how long I'm going to do that. Sales have been kind of pouring in since I did. So once there's enough sales to make my year end well on book sales, I'm going to go ahead and put the price back up. So I do it now. This would make a great gift, especially for if you have a young person in your life that could use a little bit of motivation, say age 15 to about 35. This book was really written with that demographic in mind. This is what I would have written to myself at that age bracket if I had known the things I know now and could send a letter to myself. It would be the 65,000-word book. Again, Laws of Life, Ditch the System, Design Your Life. It's been really great having this this book do so well, and I thank all of you who have made that happen for me. I really appreciate you. If you've read it and it did something for you and you haven't yet left me a review, please do so. It helps us reach more people. With that, I'm going to sign off. Thanks to everybody that tuned in today. Have a great day and have a great holiday next week. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.